The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Ambassador McCarthy is here. Deborah is here.
Is that okay?
bringing everything together. But speak about, I know that Deborah is going to talk about the institution. And I know that Professor Jackson told her she wants to speak after Deborah. Ambassador, then I thought Jennifer, and then Deborah was saying, well, maybe you can try to bring everything all together.
Well, Julio has the experience, but that's okay.
I was picturing the rest of the deck on my desk, and he looks at it, and he took a lot of these, and he goes, oh, there I am.
I was almost born then.
Yes, there we go. I think there is a little bit of
skipping.
That doesn't impress me. What impresses me is that he's still playing tennis and golf and always has
a little bit outside there.
Okay. That's okay.
I don't want you to.
Yeah, no, that's all right. I can always be on.
No, come, please. Yeah. I moved up.
So we're going in this order?
Yes.
Okay. So Deborah, then John, then Leo, then me.
He's doing like Privy Council stuff or something. Yeah.
So from Bill Crosby. On this side of this. So yeah. You can get to it from if you go on 49th, and then, you're gonna just go up Sedgwick, whatever that is, about five blocks. And then, up 49th, and you turn left, and it'll be 1.5 blocks. Or you can go on 46th. Or if you come out, you go left here, go right on 47, and then you just go up to Sedgwick, right on Sedgwick, 47th, and then right on Sedgwick, and then it'll be the third house on the right. But anyway.
Oh, no, I haven't gotten anything.
I'm gonna bring it for you.
Okay.
I just want to make sure that they...
Okay.
All right. All right.
See John at all?
Well, I'm going to soon.
And all this kind of stuff. So I don't know where my GMF gang is. I put some of those papers out too, the hard copies.
I mean,
John just arrived.
That's good. Okay, Jennifer.
Okay, if we could all get seated, please.
Phone off.
Thank you.
That thing I never remember to do.
My name is Patty Dalai. I'm a professor of law here at American University, Washington College of Law, and I teach international economic law and WTO law. It's really my great pleasure to be in welcoming all of you today to American University, Washington College of Law, and to be moderating this very distinguished panel. It's really, it is really a distinct honor for me. On behalf of Dean Claudio Grossman, I also welcome you all here. Unfortunately, Dean Grossman had to be in Baton Rouge and could not be here himself. Dean Grossman's support for this program, however, has been unwavering, and for all that we do in the area of international comparative and transnational law, law of international organizations and international economic relations. It was Dean Grossman's vision for the international program that brought me and many others to this school, a global outlook that is not imposed but is integral to who we are. It is a part of our DNA to ignore national boundaries and to look at issues relating to global governance. It was also Dean Grossman's initiative that allowed our two universities, Deborah Stager's and mine, the University of Ottawa and American University, to have a joint arrangement where we have joint LLM and joint JD programs between our two schools. Usually, one forgets to thank all those who have been involved in this, in organizing this, this session, and I would like to do so now in advance. First, I would like to thank my good friend and colleague, Professor Deborah Stager, whose Emerging Dynamic Global Economies, the EDGE Network, has co-sponsored this event and provided some of the funding for it. I will ask Deborah in a few minutes to speak briefly about the EDGE Network and the WTO Institutional Reform Project that she has led. I also would like to thank Jennifer Hillman and the German Marshall Fund for advertising and liaisoning with, for this event and their assistance in marketing this, specifically Mark Allegrini, the Institute for International Economic Law at Georgetown University and Christine Washington, the folks at Wilfrid Laurier University Press who have provided us with the book edited by Deborah Stager, Redesigning the WTO for the 21st Century, the copies which will be made available at the reception. Most importantly, of course, Dean Grossman for his financial support of this event and Director of Special Events Jennifer Dobson and her staff, without whom this roundtable and book launch would not be possible. As I was thinking today about how it is that we here at WCL have gotten to host this event, I realized that it all goes back to an earlier conference organized 5 years ago in 2005 entitled Trade as Guarantor of Peace, Liberty, and Security? It was in my capacity then as a chair of the American Society of International Law's International Economic Group to organize that conference. It was in connection with that conference that I had the good fortune to first meet Ambassador Lacarte and Professor Stager, Deborah, which proved to be a wonderful personal as well as professional relationship, beginning of a very wonderful relationship. It was also the last time that I welcomed to the law school, notwithstanding our proximity, Professor John Jackson. ASO published in the proceedings of that conference a book that was entitled Trade as Guarantor of Peace, Liberty, and Security, Critical, Historical, and Empirical Perspectives. That conference looked at the past and the present condition of the multilateral trading system in 2005. Today we are going to speak about the future. But if we do not know the past, we cannot understand the present or accurately predict the future. In February 2005, in this very same room, we had the good fortune to have Ambassador Lacarte speak about the role of the Bretton Woods institutions in securing peace. I was just with him in my office, and he looked at the book, Genesis of the GATT, and he picked up the front cover of it. There's a picture of the 1947 London Conference, and immediately he said, "Oh, London Conference, there I am." And he pointed to where he was sitting around at that conference. This is indeed an honor to have somebody who was there at the Genesis of the GATT. We had the IMF historian at that conference, James Batten, who spoke about his work and the history of the Bretton Woods institutions. The question was, even then, does that architecture, does that post-World War II architecture work today? Are we today still looking towards these institutions in the same way? Are they equipped to guarantee, in the end, peace for the world? Can they fulfill the role that was envisioned for them? In 2005, perhaps Doha was still alive, but there are already great worries about the stalemate and about the multilateral trading systems facing this proliferation of bilateral and regional arrangements, and those concerns were expressed. That was also the 10th anniversary of the WTO. Much has happened, or perhaps has not happened, since 2005, with a moribund Doha round, stalemate in the negotiation, and a U.S. president, first President Bush, and now President Obama, with no fast-track authority. Singular exception is, of course, the dispute settlement system that has continued to be very active and successful, and members of this roundtable should be credited for their role in creating this dispute settlement system and their role in it. But this is not a group that rests on its laurels. These people care about the multilateral trading system because they were there when it was put together and they wanted to succeed. This specific roundtable was initiated first as part of our intention to launch the book edited by Professor Steger, in which I have a chapter and for which Ambassador Lakarta has written the foreword. But this book is part of a larger project that has been ongoing for many years, and I would like to now turn to Deborah to say a few words about the EDGE Network, the broader project, which has resulted in the first phase in the publication of this book. You can sit there or come up, whichever one you
wish. It's probably in the interest of time, it's easier to just sit. Thank you very much, Patty Day. And thank you very much for organizing this roundtable today. As Patty Day has said, this book emanates from an international collaborative project on institutional strengthening of the World Trade Organization that was organized by the Emerging Dynamic Global Economies Network and funded by the Networks of Centers of Excellence Canada and the International Development Research Center, IDRC, in Canada. The project commenced as an idea in 2007 at a little meeting that was held on the margins of the annual WTO conference that Professor Jackson, the Institute for International Economic Law and the British Institute of International Comparative Law always hold on the WTO in London. And we had a number of leading scholars there, including Professor Jackson. And that was sort of the launch of this project. We sort of discussed ideas about how we would frame a project on institutional strengthening of the WTO. And the project involved scholars, not the necessarily the established scholars in the field, but we deliberately tried to bring in scholars from developing countries and particularly some younger scholars to try to get broad, different perspectives on some of the key issues facing the trading system in the future, but looking in particular at institutional issues. The inspiration really came from the report of the Consultative Board to the Director General, Supachai Panichpakdi, the Sutherland Report, which Professor Jackson, of course, participated in and made a very significant contribution to. That report, the Sutherland Report, was published in 2005, but as you know, it was largely that it has not been really adopted or followed up on by WTO members. And it made some very important recommendations to the WTO, but it really has not attracted a lot of attention. Instead, of course, the very important focus has been on the Doha round. Subsequent to that, of course, has been the Warwick Commission report, which also has come up with some recommendations relating to institutional strengthening of the WTO. The ideas in the Warwick Commission report reflected some of the same ideas that we saw in the Sutherland report, but again, that report also fell sort of on deaf ears in Geneva pretty well. And so our project picked up on and was inspired by the Sutherland report. And we focused on three major research themes: decision making and internal management of the WTO, relationship between the WTO and regional trade agreements, and transparency. With respect to transparency in particular, this is a topic that Sylvia Ostry has said, and I think quite cogently, has been largely ignored, and yet is a really important issue for the future, particularly when you think about China acceding to the WTO. And there are at least, I think, five or six chapters in this book about transparency. Sorry. Now, one thing I want to make clear about this book is it doesn't make proposals about how the WTO should be reformed, not concrete proposals. It was written more as an attempt to raise awareness about areas in which the WTO needs to be strengthened. I guess the feeling was that these issues are not, for some reason, even on the radar screen of WTO members. And my concern in particular was that awareness needed to be raised in Geneva in particular and in capitals among WTO members to the importance of these issues. And so if we accomplish one thing with this book, my goal was to raise awareness about the really critical importance of the issues. It wasn't necessarily to come out with a set of proposals that we felt that governments should necessarily adopt. The critical point was to come out with some arguments for why strengthening was needed. I'll come back to some of the reasons why I think institutional strengthening at this critical point in history is important in my presentation later. I won't go into details at this point. But with that, Patty Day, I think I'm going to conclude on sort of the genesis of the book and thank you and Washington College of Law, Jennifer Dabson in particular. I would like to thank IDRC and Canada in particular for their funding of the project and of this particular roundtable, and the German Marshall Fund and the Institute for International Economic Law for helping us to circulate and advertise the event. So thank you very much to everyone.
Thank you very much, Deborah. I just want to ask everybody to please make sure that their cell phones are on silent or turned off, any laptops, the voice, the sound, this volume is put down. I would like to very briefly introduce the roundtable participants, our speakers. If I wanted to actually speak about their accomplishments, we would be here all night just doing that. So I apologize in advance to them because I'm not going to do a good enough job. However, the bios of everyone are available, and they were distributed with the conference materials. We are going to start in the order in which the panelists are seated. Professor Deborah Steger, who is a professor at the University of Ottawa, where she teaches in the fields of international trade, investment, public international law, founder and leader of the EDGE Network on Global Economic Governance, and senior fellow at the Center for International Governance and Innovation, CIGI. She was the first director of the appellate body secretariat of WTO in Geneva. During the Uruguay round, she was the senior negotiator for Canada on dispute settlement and the establishment of the WTO, as well as the principal counsel to the government of Canada for all of the Uruguay round agreements. From 1991 to 1995, she was the general counsel of the Canadian International Trade Tribunal. She has chaired the WTO dispute settlement panel and has acted as counsel to governments in several WTO disputes. Speaking after her will be Professor John Jackson. Professor Jackson joined the Georgetown faculty after a distinguished career at University of Michigan. Professor Jackson is also the director of the Institute of International Economic Law. He has been a visiting professor, faculty member at the University of Delhi, University of Brussels, a consultant on legal education at the Ford Foundation, research scholar at the GATT, and a Rockefeller Foundation fellow in Brussels, Belgium. He has served as general counsel of the Office of the President's Special Representative for Trade, 1973 to 1974, and associate vice president of academic affairs at the University of Michigan. Over the years, he has advised the U.S. and various foreign governments, international organizations, and in 2000 serves as chairperson of the WTO panel for trade dispute procedures. We already spoke about his involvement with the Sullivan Report. Professor Jackson has served as a member of the Board of Editors for the American Journal of International Law, Law and Policy in International Business, International Tax, and Business Lawyer, Fordham International Law Journal. Professor Jackson has received numerous honors. The most important, most recent important honors include the Manley O. Hudson Medal Award, awarded him in 2008 by the American Society of International Law, and Honorary Doctorate Award in October 2008 by the European Union Institute in Florence, Italy. I know personally for any of us who teach WTO law, he is the person we look to for all that we know. Following him will be, of course, a legend, and no exaggeration, Ambassador Julio Lacarte Muro. Ambassador Lacarte was the first chairman and a member of the WTO appellate body from 1995 to 2001 and former chair of the Uruguay Round negotiations. Ambassador Lacarte also has served as ambassador of Uruguay to many countries, including the U.S., Germany, EC, Japan, and Argentina. Ambassador Lacarte was prominently involved with the GATT, serving as Deputy Executive Secretary of the GATT and Permanent Representative President of the GATT Council. Following Ambassador is Jennifer Hillman. Jennifer Hillman is currently serving as a member of the WTO's appellate body. She serves as also Senior Transatlantic Fellow with the German Marshall Fund of the United States. Prior to her appointment at the WTO, she was a Distinguished Visiting Fellow and Adjunct Professor at Georgetown University Law Center. In March 2007, she completed 9 years of service as a commissioner on the United States International Trade Commission after serving as General Counsel and Ambassador and Chief Textile Negotiator at the Office of U.S. Trade Representative. Finally, but not least, is our economist on the panel, sort of outnumbered by the lawyers and in the law school, is Jeffrey Schott, who joined the Institute for International Economics in 1983 and currently is senior fellow working on international trade policy and economic sanctions. Jeff has taught at Princeton University, at Georgetown University, has been a senior associate at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, an official of the U.S. Treasury Department. During his Treasury tenure, he was a negotiator of the subsidies code in the Tokyo round of multilateral trade negotiations. Currently, he is a member of the Trade and Environment Policy Advisory Committee of the USTR and the Advisory Committee on International Economic Policy of the U.S. Department of State. So I'm going to now turn to Deborah. I would ask each speaker to speak for about 10 minutes, and you're welcome to come up here or remain seated, whichever one you prefer.
Okay. Well, the topic that I've chosen is WTO vibrant or irrelevant, robust or bust. And I wanted to just throw out a bunch of thoughts at the beginning. I think when you think about the WTO, you have to think about a number of things from an institutional perspective. We have, first of all, the impact of the Doha Development Round impasse. The financial crisis, the recent financial crisis, has raised potentially new barriers, subsidies, relevance for the WTO of that. We've had the recent explosion of regionalism. Many people think it wasn't a problem until we started to see big power regional trade agreements being negotiated. One of the biggest ones that's currently being negotiated is Canada and the EU, which are currently negotiating not even a trade agreement, but a deep economic integration agreement, which I happen to be working fairly closely with, sort of embedded with, as part of an academic project that the EU is funding. Bilateral investment treaties. We have in the world today over 2,000 bilateral investment treaties, as well as a number of RTAs, as you know, that have investment chapters in them. The investment web, when you look at it, is far more complex and fragmented than the trade spaghetti bowl. And then we have the emerging economies building all kinds of new alliances out there. The big question is, you know, are they going to continue to work within the existing systems? Are they building their own alliances? How does this all relate to the WTO? Will the WTO and the multilateral system continue to be able to hold together? These are really critical, important issues for the future. And then when you look at all of these sort of institutional structural issues, you have to consider on top of that the new substantive policy issues that are being negotiated and debated and discussed in policy circles: climate change, energy, financial regulation, and the not-so-new issues, investment competition. And you have to think about what the role of the WTO in all of this is today. And in particular, I guess the problem that I've been thinking about for a number of years is the inability of the WTO to negotiate new rules or to amend its agreements. This puts pressure, and Jennifer's going to talk about this in her presentation, so I'm not going to talk about it in any detail. This puts a lot of pressure, or potentially will put pressure in the future, on the dispute settlement system. Will the WTO become irrelevant in the future if it has an imbalance, as Claude Barfield has written about, he's sitting here today, there's an imbalance between the rulemaking, the negotiating side of the WTO, and the dispute settlement side of the WTO? Does the WTO therefore need institutional strengthening? I've been told in Geneva not to use the word reform, so I'm trying very hard not to use it anymore. You'll note I'm using the word strengthening now, because reform implies there's something wrong with the WTO. To remain robust, vibrant, and relevant in the 21st century. So I happen to think that the WTO does need some strengthening, or possibly even institutional reform. Why? Well, for a number of reasons. We have seen that there is a major shifting global power balance in the world today, with the rise of the emerging economies, China and India and Brazil in particular, but China, of course, is the big one, the rising influence of developing countries. In the Uruguay round institutional negotiation, as Sylvia Austria and many others have told me before, the negotiators didn't get the job done. John Jackson has also said, you know, the negotiators came out with a charter that leaves the amending procedure and the rulemaking negotiating machinery in some ways, in many ways, more cumbersome than it was before, not easier to actually amend the agreements. As Claude and others have pointed out, the dispute settlement system may actually be stronger now and more binding and automatic than the rulemaking side, which is very cumbersome. Decision-making has become ineffective, and some people have said impossible. I don't think it's impossible, but it's cumbersome, definitely. I have great fears that the new international economic agenda is not being addressed. I'll come back to that in a few minutes. And, of course, there's a specter of growing regionalism, which the WTO doesn't seem to be capable of being able to monitor or surveil. The TPR decision recently was a step forward, but the WTO clearly needs to do a lot more than that. And there's the big legitimacy issue, both internal legitimacy and external legitimacy. So let's come back to some of these specific points. I'm not going to go into all of them in the time that I have. Some of these I've addressed in the book, but my thinking has evolved in the 2 years or so since I've written the chapter, so I want to update my thinking a bit. First of all, the rulemaking problems with the rulemaking machinery. Well, there was a major transformation from the GATT to the WTO, but the decision-making rules are very cumbersome, and as a result, the decision-making rules, particularly the amendment procedures in Article 10 of the WTO Charter, are not used by and large. Decisions are taken by consensus, and when new agreements, decisions are brought into the WTO, they're sort of done informally. They're not used. They're not brought in through the Article 10 procedure because it's too cumbersome. There are many problems with the rulemaking process, and what I have said in my articles is that it's not, in my view, simply the consensus principle, simply at the back end of the process, at the end of the day, but I think part of the problem is at the front end of the process. Part of the problem is that there's no formal procedure in the WTO, unlike other international organizations, for proposals to bubble up and to come forward in an organized way. And I think that more thought should be put into developing structures for proposals to actually be brought forward in the WTO. The Director General has a very weak role in the WTO, unlike other international organizations. There are no executive bodies, there's no management board, and the WTO does not have this similar structures to other international organizations, and I'm not suggesting for a minute that it necessarily should have exactly the same structure as other international organizations, but I think that we could look to other international organizations and try to develop a new model for the WTO that would work for the WTO. Haven't proposed anything specifically, but I at least would like people to start thinking about this. Dispute settlement and decision-making imbalance. Well, again, Claude was the one that first alerted us to some of these issues. The Uruguay round reforms propelled the dispute settlement system to a judicial model. There are binding decisions. Of course, the appellate body was created. But when you counter this with a weak negotiating and rulemaking system, you have an imbalance. In any system, it's very important that the political and legislative bodies have the ultimate power to correct the judicial bodies. But in the WTO, that is not possible, and it hasn't created, I don't think, a real problem yet. But one worries about the future. And whether it could create a problem in the future. And so that's an issue for the future. Now to the points that I worry about more seriously and that I didn't write about because I wasn't thinking about them as deeply in the past. The new international economic agenda. Well, here you might ponder about the mandate of the WTO. I think that it is expanding. And, you know, the Doha round is largely about market access and goods, agriculture and services. The original Doha round, new issues, competition and investment were dropped at Cancun. In the meantime, investment is now being dealt with in bilateral investment treaties and RTAs. There's been an explosion, as I said, a whole web of investment treaties has been created. Not sure that's a good thing. But there are new critical international economic issues that are kind of combined trade, environment, finance, technology, human rights issues out there. Climate change, energy, financial regulation, exchange rates, corruption, rule of law being dealt with out there in the policy community. And one wonders how we're going to deal with all of these issues. A lot of these issues have trade implications. And I guess what worries me is governments take measures. The WTO rules are not appropriate to deal with these policy issues. And yet, I can anticipate, you can anticipate, we've already seen big debates on climate change, that there will be challenges to unilateral government measures in the future in the WTO, under the WTO dispute settlement mechanism. And the challenges will be brought under rules that were not created to deal with these new policy measures or policy objectives. And we're going to see this not only in climate change, but we're going to see it in other areas too. We're going to see, for example, I've already written and begun to think about the subsidies agreement. Subsidies agreement was negotiated, you know, only a few years ago. But the issues that are relevant today were not even in people's minds when the subsidies agreement was negotiated. I mean, Jeff knows all about the subsidies agreement, and other people in the room know all about the subsidies agreement. Jeff negotiated it in the Tokyo round. The issues have changed. If negotiators were to sit down today and think seriously about what the critical issues are for the subsidies agreement, the issues have changed. But WTO negotiators haven't put their minds to the new important critical substantive issues. And yet the cases could come to the dispute settlement mechanism. And it's left with the old rules. And so this is something that is really quite important. And, you know, there's an imbalance because the dispute settlement mechanism will have to deal with those issues. But at the same time, the problem with the rulemaking side of the WTO is that the members can't amend or change the rules to make them respond to the current day realities. The other big issue is, of course, growing regionalism. Once again, the WTO moves slowly because of the cumbersome rulemaking procedures. The regional trade agreements are a lot easier and faster to negotiate. I know Ambassador Licarte is going to talk about this particular issue, so I don't want to dwell on it. I'm concerned about the big power RTAs that are currently being negotiated. There is a move to multilateralize RTAs. People within the WTO are starting to think about this. There are, I think, some interesting ideas that are starting to come forth about enhanced surveillance. Roles for the WTO, enhanced surveillance, enhanced TPR, maybe even a role for WTO dispute settlement. Some of these ideas may seem to be way out there, but at the same time, I think it's important to discuss these ideas and debate them and not to close our minds to any ideas, even if they seem a little bit far out, if we want to preserve the WTO as a vibrant and effective international organization. So, finally, I wanted to just talk very briefly about legitimacy. I don't look at the WTO as being completely unique. I think of it as one among other international organizations. The International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, are going through reform processes right now. They have legitimacy problems. They have probably bigger accountability and effectiveness problems than the WTO has. But I do think that we're at a critical time in history, there is a transformative opportunity in history for the international organizations generally to look at themselves and to think about strengthening and reforming themselves. And I think it's really a critical time to think about the future, to think not only about the changing global power balance and the fact that we have to think differently about the role that different countries are going to play in the WTO in the future, but I also think we have to think about the expanding mandate of the WTO and how international economic regulation more generally is changing, the issues are changing. And finally, we have to think about giving voice not only to developing countries, but to non-state stakeholders. So with that, I will close and let us move on to Professor Jackson. Thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. I just want to encourage those who are sitting on the stairs, please, there's empty chairs up here. Please come up, join us. It must not be that comfortable to sit there. Please join us. There are empty seats here. There are empty seats up front. Invariably, nobody likes to sit in the front, regardless of the context. Without further ado, Professor Jackson.
Okay, John.
I'm sorry. Oops.
Well, thank you very much, both thanks to the organizers of this event. And Deborah, we've talked a lot about different things along this line for many years, and it's interesting to hear the inventory of problems that she put forward to us. I myself have been somewhat concerned with that inventory. When Deborah asked me to take this talk on, I said, okay, I don't want to prepare anything. I don't want to be anything that I have to prepare. I'm just going to react to others. So I thought that maybe I should be at the tail end of the queue for the talking. But I'll say a few things that are in my mind at the moment, and then maybe I can save some minutes for coming back at a later point and talking about that. It is true, of course, that the WTO looks like it has, it's in a serious funk, if you want to put it that way. Nothing really seems to be getting done. I have to say that there are various causes of that, but a very important cause, I think a very central cause, is to the lack of leadership. And by that I mean the lack of United States leadership. I think the United States has, in the last couple of years, has really played a very careful and quiet and non-decisive position, particularly in trade. And of course, there are many other problems on the agenda of the United States, and maybe I'll come back to some of that. But I think we just have to face that. That is really, I think, the most serious detriment right now. Now, things are happening, nevertheless. The organization, the WTO organization, is not defunct. It is, of course, spectacularly useful in the dispute settlement process, as has been mentioned. It is perhaps spectacularly inefficient in the negotiation rulemaking process. But indeed, there is a third leg to this stool. There's something in between, and that is a series of committee and administrative processes going on in Geneva in the WTO halls, if you will. I have not been too cognizant of that particular aspect or dimension of the WTO until more recently, and in particularly last June when I was there for some time talking to some of the administrative people, the various leaders in the WTO, and I was just totally impressed with the kinds of things that seem to be going on within powers that don't particularly need hard, concrete treaty making or amendments, but activities that are relevant to the ongoing operation of the organization. So I think we shouldn't overlook that. I know the Director General himself has made some of the points I just made a couple of years ago at Georgetown, but it really struck me this time. And there are various types of activities, of course, various agendae, if you will, that are going on. But one I might mention, because it is, in a sense, an alternative to the dispute settlement system, and that is a less litigious process, a process of sort of committee-like attention and discussion of problems that are brought to it by members, and then discussed through, and in many cases, issues actually resolved. And the most significant of those, I think, is the SPS committee that I've seen. It really is quite interesting what is happening and what kinds of progress can be made. Now, there is a huge agenda out there waiting, of course, in the trade area. There are just all sorts of issues. Some of them were mentioned already. There are the climate and environmental issues that really are already embedded in certain controversial questions of legality and so forth in connection with the trade organization. There is a bunch of financial things, which I want to come back to a little bit. There is, as has already been mentioned, investment, competition policy, technology, human rights. That's really pushing the frontier of the organization, incidentally, whether the organization is ripe for getting into some of the human rights issues and what kind of pressures could be used with trade measures. And that's very, very tricky. But we've got a lot of those issues coming forward. Among other things, though, there are those that say that the WTO, in the light of the financial crisis, the WTO has proven its worth. That, in fact, on the whole, it has prevented really dangerous processes of increased protectionism. Of course, there's some here and there and yon. And there are those that like to count the individual numbers of this and that action and come up with fairly large numbers that we've had 30 type actions of barriers and so on. But when you add the actual economic impact of these many, many actions, it isn't very large. And so, and arguably, this has been part of the discipline of the WTO, part of the success overall, and not so much directed at the dispute settlement side or the negotiation side. It's really sort of ongoing administrative type action, committee type action, that can have a considerable amount of effect if worked on adequately and correctly. Now, should there be any stronger initiatives in the WTO? And the answer is, of course, yes. But who's going to do it, and how is it going to be done? Maybe we should step back and say, well, there are lots of little things that might be done. Well, not so little, but not so grand as a huge trade round. Among other things, there is debate about what to do about Doha. There are those who are saying we ought to kill it now because it's out of date anyway in the subject matter it's addressing, and then start a new one. You could call it an Obama round if you want to or whatever. But nevertheless, there is a fear that that would be seen as too much of a failure. So there is a pretty strong impetus not to kill the Doha round exactly. Now, will any of this change? Will any of the Doha complex change as a consequence of the November election or later elections? It's very, very hard, I find, to predict that. And I read a lot of different sources and talk to a lot of different sources, and I don't see much in the way of predictability about how that's going to be. So what one might do is take a look at the Doha and dice it up, separate it into parts. There are some constructive parts. There are some parts of it that could be conceivably acceptable to a broad part of the membership of the WTO. And the question about that process, incidentally, I have to come back to a little bit. There's some real tough legal tangles. But nevertheless, one might see an idea of putting in place something that has been on the table of tariff-free benefits for the least developed countries. And one might also see putting in place similar tariff-free benefits for other slices of the activity of trade policy, if you will. So that's there's some possibilities there that could be very interesting. Now, there has been some discussion in this city over the last 4 or 5 years of things much more heroic, such as the Bretton Woods revisited, a new Bretton Woods, a complete overhaul of the institutional mechanism of the international economic system. I must say, whenever I think about the Bretton Woods process, and go back and look a little bit at the process, the history of it, and so forth, I come away with awe, just enormous awe of the leaders in 1944 in particular, in the middle and in the waning years of the terrible war, of course. But nevertheless, the foresight that they brought to their task of trying to design institutions that would greatly inhibit the kinds of activities that could lead to another war. In many ways, we could say, although there are many, many causes for the situation of avoiding a Third World War so far, but one of those certainly has been the Bretton Woods system. And the Bretton Woods system, of course, has included the GATT and now the WTO. Curiously, of course, the GATT was birth defected, many defects in the process, and a protocol of provisional application, provisional, mind you, for 47 years. So all that is the background, but there's an ingenuity that has been embraced in that process. You can look at some of the historical evolutions of the WTO, or of the GATT, for instance, particularly in the dispute settlement. The dispute settlement started out being a little tweaking of a few clauses in the light of the failure of the ITO idea, several paragraphs only, and an attempt to say, well, this at least should bring governments together to negotiate better. But there was a counter opinion that said, no, it's more than a negotiation. There really are firm obligations that can be put in place by a decision-making process. And that began to develop in the 1950s, and particularly towards the end of the 1950s. And then early in 1962, we had a case by Uruguay, incidentally, that created a new jurisprudence about what would be the dispute settlement system, moving away from the ambiguities of nullification and impairment toward a violation as the central focus. And then that continued to grow. And then that continued to grow with the difficulties of a consensus process that undermined it, and that then was overhauled in the Uruguay round process. What you see in this history really is sort of a grounds-up process, a lot of trial and error, if you will, instead of a top-down process. And it's been really quite ingenious, and when you look at it now, and when you look at it where it is now, I think there's reason to be optimistic that at least something could happen. Now, what else could you do in the trade side? One of the things that has been debated a little bit in circles that are not very realistic, including those that I go around with, why not think in terms of a massive FTA, a worldwide FTA, if you will, open to any member of the WTO that wants to enter it, but every member doesn't have to, compliant to Article 24 so that you get over the MFN problem, although MFN does not itself need to be a huge blockage, incidentally. Just think of that. Think really big. What kinds of things would you put in it? Some of them I think were mentioned, but one could just go beyond. One certainly could add to the agenda of subject matters. For instance, it really is logical that there would be a investment portion and a competition portion in the WTO. Those issues are very, very closely linked to trade, and it would make a lot of sense to have part of the WTO organization that would look at each of those subjects. That, too, has been very very controversial in the past and probably is not realistic, at least in the near future. But something's going to happen to those issues. Something is going to evolve because more and more we're in a globalized world where the nation states cannot act independently alone and get anything done. More and more they're going to have to look more broadly. So finally, let me turn just a bit to the big, what is right now the very big question. That's the financial crisis. It's very, very interesting to examine how that is being handled. One of the things that's really interesting is that despite the fact there is a whole treaty chapter in the WTO, i.e. GATS, the General Agreement on Trade and Services, which would be highly relevant to the difficulties of trying to regulate the world financial sector. And yet there's been almost no attention to that, to the GATS for that. There is, some of my colleagues on the Journal of International Economic Law, for instance, which we edit, a number of colleagues, have discussed this. And one, Thomas Cotier, has written a very appealing article for the journal about the clash of culture between the finance people of the world and the regulatory trade people of the world. They don't want to talk to each other. And he sort of lays it out at how difficult that is. And, of course, some of you who have negotiated in the Uruguay round remember how difficult, indeed, were some of those negotiations, the Treasury versus USTR and things like that. So it really is striking in many ways, and to some extent it affected the original Bretton Woods Conference, you remember, because the original Bretton Woods Conference said in their record that we need a trade organization to fill out the triad, but that's not our job. In fact, we don't have the competence to do that. It has to be done by the trade people instead of the finance people. So one of the questions is, can we cross over that? Can we implement things that really need to be involved both ways, both trade and finance? There certainly are such, and we could talk about that a little more. Now, what, for example? Suppose you accept the notion that we're doing enormous innovations of regulation on international financial services and so on. There's huge, huge amounts of attention. A lot of that, however, has been at the nation-state level. For instance, the United States has passed a massive statute directing attention to this type of thing. And other governments, the UK, for instance, and EU is sort of operating together among its members, but nevertheless pushing ahead, are doing this. But they are beginning to realize that they can't do it alone, any part of that. It has to be done in connection with some kind of cooperative mechanism. So there's institution making going on. We have G20. We have Basel III, for what it may be worth. We don't know for sure. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There's just a lot of these things actually going on, and they're going to have to be assimilated into some kind of institutional structures, probably plural is going to be used. And so the question is, what needs to be a part of that ingredient? And one of the questions that is raised is you need to have a dispute settlement system as part of that landscape. And that really makes some of the bankers blanch, if you will, because there really is a quite strong opposition to the thinking that we need a dispute settlement system of the WTO type, for instance, in the finance area. The finance people are about 90% against it. There is a good 10%, though, that favors it, actually. It's quite interesting what is going on in that discussion. So those are issues that really need our attention. And I can't be too specific on that because it's all extremely confusing and I've tried to grapple with a number of parts of it. I have to say that we, in the Journal of International Economic Law, we are just at the cusp now of completing and about to publish a special issue on the financial crisis, devoted not to stimulus packages or recession problems, but devoted to the regulatory part of it, the regulatory question. So what kind of activity do you need to have the finance sector operate as efficiently, you might say, as the trade sector does in the dispute settlement system? I think my time is probably up. Maybe I'm over time, but in any event, I'll stop there.
Ambassador Lacarte, would you like to come up or stay seated there?
Thank you, Josh. You will notice that Professor Lai mentioned that I had recognized myself in an old photograph of the Preparatory Committee of the GATT. And it's an old picture, and it's hard to make out the faces. Only I know the trick of how to recognize myself. I have to look at the guy who's got all the big dark hair. As you can see, things have changed in between. Now, Professor Lai, on top of that, is demanding that we reform the WTO for you in 10 minutes. So that's what I will try to do right away. All right, well, firstly, may I say that the book, Redesigning the WTO for the 21st Century, the book launch that we're going to attend afterwards, is not the first effort in recent times to reform the WTO. We have the Warwick Report, which is a very thorough piece of work, and there is the Sunderland Report, in which Professor Jackson participated, which was an official document of the WTO. And it's rather interesting that although these are very good and thorough reports making all kinds of useful proposals, nothing has happened. Nothing has happened. Over a number of years, these reports have come and gone, and nothing has happened. So just keep that in mind, because we're going to come back to that in just a minute. Now, most everybody who concerns himself or herself with the future of the WTO wants to reform it. We all do. Yes, a number of these items are very clear-cut. They appear everywhere. Cooperation with the bank and fund, for example. A coherence in the establishment of world economic policies. That's one. A dispute settlement, decision-making, good governance, the preferential tariff agreements which are proliferating in the world. These are all items which appear. And the Director General of WTO, Pascal Lamy, not so very long ago, in a statement he made to the General Council also, set out a number of his ideas on what should be done. But I repeat, nothing happens. Now, what can be an explanation for all this? To begin with, the whole structure, firstly of GATT, and now of the WTO, which just follows on to GATT, was worked out just after the Second World War. That was 60 years ago, in terms of the world as it was at that time. And is the world today the same as it was, say, in 1950? Well, clearly not. And over the last 10 years, we have seen a very significant shift in the world balance of power. The emerging economies like China, India, Indonesia, Brazil, are coming to the fore. They weren't there particularly in 1950. Now they exist. In fact, some of them were colonies at that time. Today they are sovereign countries with dynamic economies. And there is a shift in the world that has not yet been absorbed by the WTO. The bank and fund have seen this shift, and they have both already launched reform mechanisms for themselves. They want to bring themselves up to date. Why not the WTO? One possible explanation is that change at the GATT and more recently in the WTO comes as a consequence of negotiating rounds. This we saw in the Tokyo round, this we saw in the Uruguay round, and in the present Doha round, there has been a great deal of work on rules. And if you would look at the report of the chairman of the Rules Committee in the Doha round, you will find some very interesting and very worthwhile proposed amendments. And why should this happen during the rounds? Simply because the WTO is an agglomeration of benefits and obligations to countries. Everybody wants to know he's not losing out in the final deal. That's why it's difficult to make a final deal in the WTO. There are 150 countries involved in this process of the Doha round. They find it difficult to come to a final agreement. So the practice that has grown up is that change takes place during the rounds. Right. Now, for example, just one example, at the close of the Uruguay round, which now lies way back in the past, it was decided by ministerial decision to review the dispute settlement system after a period of a few years. We're still waiting. We're still waiting. It's 15 or 20 years. The drafts are there. I had them filed at home, but I don't even bother to look at them anymore. No. So what is happening at the WTO is that its procrastination is creating a vacuum. Practice has shown that when negotiating rounds drag along and appear to not succeed, countries find other ways. In the Uruguay round, they started going into preferential trade agreements. And preferential trade agreements erode the MFN rule on which the WTO functions. The basis of the WTO is the most favored nation clause. And the preferential agreements are all a negation of the most favored nation clause. And there are now hundreds of these agreements. For example, the European Union has signed many dozens of these agreements, very many dozens, worldwide. And Chile has been a pioneer in this matter. And Chile has now, I remember the former president, Madame Bachelet, telling us some time back that Chile had preferential access to something like 3 billion consumers in the world because of her preferential treatment. So when the WTO hangs fire, people do other things, which are not necessarily good things for the WTO. Now, there's another question we could ask ourselves. At the Second World War, no less, it was conceived that the bank, the fund, and what was going to be called the International Trade Organization, which was substituted for by the GATT, would cooperate in determining worldwide economic policies. Has that ever happened? My answer is no. And I think everybody else would agree with that. No. The bank and fund follow their way, the WTO follows its own way, and there is no substantive, coherent action among the three. If this were to happen, I think the world economy would be a lot better off. So, if this is the situation, what can we do? Where do we go from here? Now, you must conceive that a negotiation in the WTO is leads to hard bargaining and negotiations that are protracted, they're difficult, and they're controversial. Because the WTO is a world of hard law. Please underline those words, hard law. Whatever you agree to in the WTO, somebody's going to make sure you pay attention to. And if you do not do that, there is a dispute settlement system to make sure that you do do it. So there is a difference between the WTO and many other intergovernmental organizations which function on the basis of soft law. For example, a UN General Assembly resolution may be carried by an overwhelming majority. There may be only five countries that don't sign up for it, but they're not obliged by it at all. They don't have to. Whereas in the WTO, whatever you commit yourself to, you have to do. So this means that the difficulties are very many in this matter. Furthermore, how is decision-making taking place in the WTO? It's by consensus. What does consensus mean? It's very nearly a veto. If any one country, of the 150-odd members puts up its hands and says, I formally oppose this decision, it cannot be taken. You may say, well, this is a very bad thing to do in the WTO, but that's how it went. And I won't go into the reasons why this has gone this way, but I'll give you two hints. One is that since every member of the WTO has a vote, and we all know that the European Union has its own internal procedures to come out with one single opinion on any subject, that means that the European Union has 25 votes. All by itself, the United States has won. That's one thing you should take into account. The second one is there are very many more developing countries than developed countries in the WTO. So if we have simply a majority vote, every vote is going to be one in favor of developing countries. And there again, there are people who are not happy with that. So the result is a difficult voting system, decision-making system. Now, you may feel that I am being extremely negative. No, I am saying things as I see them. And I see them because at this moment I think that the Doha Round, which is a key to progress, in terms of a reform of the WTO, is very much frozen, as we all know. Why? We should ask ourselves why. I have my own version, which may be a good one or it may be a bad one. In my view, we have this world situation. Most developed countries have very slow rates of economic growth at this moment. The recession has hit them. They are still coming out of the recession. There are a number of emerging economies which are registering rates of growth of 7, 8, or 9, or 10% a year. Most of South America will go up to 7% this year. China more than that, India more than that, and so on. So one wonders whether it isn't happening that developed countries are not very keen to open their markets any more than they already have to competition when they're going through a difficult economic recovery process. And this could explain the recent summit of the G20 in Toronto, where the group of 20 pledged to refrain from applying new protectionist measures for a further 3 years to the end of 2013, but everybody omitted to roll back the measures that they have been taking over the last 2 or 3 years. So there you see in real practice how some people are very reluctant to liberalize their trade. And these emerging economies are finding that even though they're not getting further market concessions in the WTO, they are prospering anyway. And any country that's registering an 8 or 9% increase in economic growth every year is very happy with conditions as they are. So there we have a problem that will have to be settled when the Doha round comes to an end, which it's going to be, because there is one thing we can all state. The Doha round will conclude, and it will conclude successfully. When that will be, and with what content that will be, I would not want to hazard a guess. But not all is bad by any means. The GATT, firstly, and the WTO have changed the scene of world trade. Until the GATT and the WTO, there was no such thing. There has never been, ever, a world organization that set out the rules of the game for trade. Before that, there was nothing. Very much the law of the jungle. The world has advanced enormously with the present system. But since the world is changing, then the mechanism of governments and countries have set out for themselves also have to change. They have to be updated. And this is the concern that I think has brought us all together today. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ambassador McCarthy. Jennifer Newman.
Not sure if I had been told in advance I was following Julio in his remarks that I would have necessarily wanted to do this. But it is certainly a pleasure for me and an honor to be on this panel with so many folks that I have worked with over the years, and I think all of whom share certainly my dedication to the WTO, as well as I think I'm hearing some of my same anxiety about its future. Jeff and I were commenting that we were both in attendance yesterday at the World Services Summit, where the USTR Ron Kirk quoted Yogi Berra when he said, "The future ain't what it used to be." And I thought, well, that's kind of a humbling remark to think about as we start to talk about the future of the WTO. I wanted to pick up a little bit on what John Jackson started with in terms of whether the WTO is in fact in a serious funk. And maybe it's because I'm an eternal optimist, but I'm going to pick a little bit about whether I think we are in fact in a funk. But I would certainly agree that in the absence of some things changing, we're certainly going to end up there. And I say that for a number of reasons. I share John's view of kind of the WTO and how it's currently functioning. I've often thought of it as a bit of a three-legged stool, where you have on the one hand a leg that is the negotiating leg, and I will hope with Julio that we'll finish the Doha round, but I think it's fair to say from those looking at it that negotiating leg is at least at this moment in time very, very weak. You have the second leg of the WTO, which I typically think of as the implementation piece of it. That's the kind of day-to-day things that are going on in Geneva. And there I would share John's view that there's a lot more happening there than some people might think about. I mean, the daily work of the WTO in terms of accepting notifications from all of its members, if you change your tariff, if you've added a subsidy, if you've entered into a regional trade agreement, if you've done any of these things, you are required to provide notifications. There's an awful lot of work going on in that area and in all of the committees, and I would certainly share John's view that among them, the SPS committee, and I would add the services committee within the WTO, are doing an awful lot of work at really bringing about agreement on what do we mean by a service, where's that line between a good and a service, what do we mean by certain phrases within the SPS agreement, where is there a consensus around certain norms of behavior. That is happening in Geneva. The problem I have with it is it's happening in pockets. So I would regard this kind of leg of our stool as stronger than the negotiating leg, but still having a lot of problems with it, part of the problems stemming from what comes of them. Everybody is notifying that they've entered into a regional trade agreement, and the WTO is putting up on its website a list of all of the regional trade agreements. But you can sort of stop right there. There isn't really a process to then say, okay, are these regional trade agreements in fact consistent with anybody's obligations under the WTO? Where do they fall within Article 24 of the GATT that says it has to cover substantially all trade? Is there a process, a meaningful process, for following up on all of these notifications? These days there's a lot of talk in Geneva on subsidies, and yet where that's an area where you're seeing probably an awful lot of subsidies being granted by an awful lot of governments around the world, many in the name of economic stimulus or crisis prevention, which are not being notified to the WTO. And again, where is there the kind of follow-up process on the notifications that are being made and on the failure to notify on the other side? So in my little apocryphal stool, we have one very weak leg, one sort of modest leg, and then you turn to dispute settlement. And there, it's easy for me to say since I'm part of the dispute settlement process, but I think everyone would say that the record to date has really been quite a strong one. I mean, I think if you even just look at the numbers in comparison to other international courts, the record and the role of the WTO dispute settlement system is really extraordinary. I mean, it's been in existence for just under 15 years now. You've had 411 cases filed, I mean, complaints brought to the WTO. Compare that, for example, to the International Court of Justice, which many would argue has a much broader jurisdiction than the WTO. In that same 15-year period of time, 41 cases have been brought to the ICJ. If you look at something, again, a narrower tribunal, the Law of the Sea, say, came into existence about a year after the WTO did. Obviously, it's covering a huge amount of space and theoretically an awful lot of disputes about it. 17 cases since its existence. So I think if you just stack up the kind of general sense of, do the members of the WTO feel comfortable coming to the dispute settlement, bringing their cases before it, and getting their cases adjudicated, I think the clear answer is yes. They wouldn't have brought that many cases had they not. So in that sense, I think the system, again, is working extremely well. The other part of it that I think is really critical is on the compliance end of it. And again, it's always going to be hard to get your arms around figures of what is the compliance rate with decisions out of the WTO. But a telling number for me is, again, when you go through the whole dispute settlement process and you come to the very end of the day, and the question is, if you have not come into compliance, you know, the last, if you will, bad option is that you can have retaliation be authorized against you. So if I look at these 411 cases, how many times has retaliation been authorized? 17 out of 411. And of those, that counts the retaliation against the U.S. Byrd Amendment 8 times. So if you didn't triple count or whatever, count them, you'd have 11 instances in which retaliation has been authorized. So presumably in all of the rest of the cases, some form of a settlement or an agreement or compliance was reached before you got to that end of the day, which again to me says a lot about where the system stands. But I then step back from that and think about, okay, so why is that? Why do countries by and large come into compliance with decisions of the dispute settlement body? Of course, we at the appellate body would like to think it's because we write beautiful, perfect, compelling, absolutely persuasive final decisions that Julio authored the first set of them to show us all the way to do these perfect opinions. Another option, just to give you some other thoughts on why that might be, but my own view is, first and foremost, it's pure economics. Most of the litigants I think, assume that tomorrow they're going to be on the winning end of the case. And if they don't come into compliance with decisions against them, they are less likely to have other countries come into compliance with decisions against them. So some of it I do think is fairly pure economics. You have at this point a somewhat limited number of litigants that are in the majority of the cases. That would largely be the United States and the European Union, but that is changing. You are starting to see a much broader array of countries be involved in the cases. The second reason I believe that countries come into compliance is much sort of more broader, that there really is, I think, a fundamental belief of most of the members of the WTO in a rules-based system, I mean, in this general notion of a rule of law. And if you believe in a rule of law and in a rules-based system, at some level, you have to comply. You have to at least attempt to comply. You have to do something about a decision that's sitting out there if you, in fact, believe and want others to believe that the rule of law governs at the end of the day. I would say, thirdly, countries come into compliance because of the negotiations. I mean, you may be disputing with Europe or whoever today, but you're going to be negotiating with them tomorrow. And again, there is this sense that you can't keep the fights and the disputes in the way of a broader agreement over negotiations. And so long as the negotiations are going on and there's a prospect of them coming to a good conclusion, I think you come into compliance because your dispute is with your negotiating partners. I would give a little bit of emphasis to the court of shame of the dispute settlement body, where when you have lost a case and you are not in compliance, every single month, all 153 countries troop in to the main meeting room in Geneva and call you out. How many months has it been since you've been out of compliance? How much trade has been affected by your lack of compliance? How long have we been waiting for compliance? And at some level, I think it's not entirely comfortable for every country to sit through that time after time if they are not in compliance. And I would say absolutely last, in my own view, is this idea of trade sanctions. Now, it's interesting to me that in a lot of other forums, people will say to me, oh, you, the WTO, you hold the big stick. The only reason you have compliance, whereas other international arrangements don't, is because you hold that big stick of sanctions. I personally am not, like I said, I think there's a lot of other factors that go into it. If I step back and think about a couple of the things that Julio was saying and about this issue of sort of where are we going and should we be in a funk yet, I would say that on the dispute settlement side, you've seen, I think, some very important evolution, which suggests to me that the WTO system in some of its parts can change in the absence of a Doha round conclusion. In other words, I don't think that everything that needs to happen in the WTO has to wait for the round to finish. And one of the things that I think you're seeing is a bit of this shift from a soft law system to a much more significant hard law system, at least on the dispute settlement side. If you look at the way the dispute settlement system works, the first 60 days of it is supposed to be a consultation where you have the opportunity to come to a mutually agreed solution. And at the very beginning, when there was a lot of low-hanging fruit of disputes, I think you saw a lot of cases settle in that way. You don't see that so much anymore. You really are moving toward a much sort of more hard law adjudicatory system. If I think now about the kinds of briefs and the kind of arguments that I hear coming in front of the appellate body, they are very, very much pure, straight-up adjudicatory arguments. What's the burden of proof? Did the other side meet their burden of proof? Was this claim, lawfully brought in the very first instance? Very much a lot of procedural and a lot of pure legal arguments, as opposed to kind of soft power arguments about the relative power or the relative strength of any particular country before you, or the relative merits, if you will, around the substance of the trade. The arguments are squarely on what are the rules, what is the WTO rule, and therefore what should be the final adjudication under that rule. And at the end of the day, when the decisions are made, they are made on a hard law basis. They're not really about, well, gee, it's the big, powerful such and such country against the smaller country. There's certainly many instances now where you have seen quite small countries prevail in their cases against the very large because of it. So you are seeing, on the one hand, this, to me, a fairly inexorable move to a very straight-up adjudicatory system within the WTO based on a pretty strong sort of hard law system, which comes to my sort of, will we ever get to a funk? Because my own concern is, I do think that system is working and working relatively well for now. And the question comes, can it be sustained over the long haul? And when I think about it, you're starting already to see a lot of pressures come on the system, which I think may not, I don't know yet, may not be able to be overcome if the negotiation leg of this stool doesn't get strengthened. Some of it's already been touched on. I will say it's very tricky for those of us that are adjudicators to sit in, if you will, in a court when you don't have a legislature sitting next to you. Because on the one hand, it cuts both ways. On the one hand, your tendency is to be very conservative, because if I get it wrong, there isn't a legislature that can swoop in and change it. So your ability to be course-corrected fairly quickly, as you would anywhere where you would have a legislature sitting by you, is not there. So that, on the one hand, leads towards a very conservative approach to how you're going to make decisions. And on the flip side, you're starting to at least hear a lot of talk of a lot of cases that might, could, will, are likely to be brought to the WTO, where you don't have any rules, you don't have any law. Okay, let's say a case on climate change comes to the WTO because there is, in some way, a trade connection to it. What law is the WTO supposed to apply? We've now decided we are an adjudicatory hard law system. What law are we applying? I mean, in the climate change area, you're looking at Article 20, an exception. You are now going to be making an entire body of law based on 27 words of what is fundamentally an exception to the rules. People say, well, regional trade agreements are the big thing. Okay, every one of those regional trade agreements typically has a dispute settlement mechanism. But you're already seeing pressure to bring what is fundamentally analogous to disputes under these regional trade agreements into the WTO system. Okay, now, so are now we, these conservative judges who are supposed to be very careful because we don't have a legislative body, going to now start applying the law out of a regional trade agreement? Says who? Where is the legislative sort of authority or power that is going to say, no, really, because these regional trade agreements have become so dominant in the world, over 400 of them, we really think actually the WTO should have some role or some connection formally to the regional trade agreements. And it's going to be, again, a very real problem to figure out how that connection gets worked out. We are on the one hand already accused in many cases of so-called gap filling or law making. And on the other hand, if you are faced with a situation in which there isn't really very much law, or the law isn't very clear, or it's clear that differences were papered over in the negotiations for the Uruguay round, and there is no legislative history, there's no sort of background to tell you how this is going to be done, you are stuck really between a rock and a hard place, which I think is only going to get sort of worse over time. So my own view is I don't think things are so bad right now. I'm not ready to get to the funk yet, but I worry. I really worry going forward that if that legislative, negotiating leg of the stool isn't at some point strengthened, all of the other good parts of the WTO, particularly the compliance with decisions coming out of the dispute settlement side of it, starts to slip away. And as people quit complying with decisions over time, it weakens the whole system. And then as the dispute settlement system weakens, it does begin to move us into this inexorable funk that John was speaking of at the beginning. So with that, I will close.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Very short.
Jeffrey Schott.
Thank you. Okay, the law discussion is over, so the rest, if you've been sitting for too long and you need to get up and leave, it's perfectly understandable. I'd like to thank the College of Law and also to the law faculty at Ottawa. Deborah and I have worked together for a long time, and I was very pleased, if not somewhat intimidated, to join this distinguished panel. I've been working on reform of the world trading system for the past 35 years, and normally that makes me the dean of any discussion of these issues. But on this panel, I'm not even in the first tier. So I'm very grateful to be here to listen to their insights. When I was working and trying to craft the rules in the trading system, and this is 30, 35 years ago, things really haven't changed that much, Deborah. I worked on the subsidy problems. And some of the things that I tried to do and was told by the lawyers in the White House that I couldn't do involved things like investment incentives, the very practices that Jennifer just mentioned that are creating or embedding in stimulus programs and infrastructure projects the seeds of possible future trade disputes over distortions of trade and investment. I tried to work about problems of agricultural subsidies, but the Congress said no. And so we've had 40 more years of agricultural trade disputes to benefit primarily lawyers. So you can thank me for failing. Same thing for civil aviation. The subsidy rules were meant to apply to civil aviation, to apply to Airbus and Boeing, to apply to Brazilian and Canadian manufacturers. But the lobbyists got to the White House, and the White House said, no, civil aviation will be exempt from the rules of the GATT. And we have had 30 years of litigation, and we're likely to see many more years of litigation, even despite the rulings out of the WTO in the past year. And we discussed the problem of currency misalignment, and is it a subsidy? And we decided, no, if you start getting into the area of implicit practices of implicit subsidies, whether an action by a government confers a benefit or an inaction by government confers a benefit, you start down a very slippery slope. And therefore, we drew the law, the rules and definitions of subsidies rather tightly. And those rules tomorrow will be opened quite broadly by the House Ways and Means Committee in the markup of new legislation. So problems are the same, and the problem is that many of them haven't been resolved. Now, when I thought, what could I say to add to this body of wisdom from the legal profession on the trading system, my natural thought was, well, I could talk about, are we in a funk on Doha and how to get out of it and what the G20 can do, but that's the topic of a talk in this room next Friday, October 1st, so I'm hoping that some of you will come back. So I thought, well, what aspect of the law could I talk about? And I thought the one that I know the most about, and that is the law of unintended consequences. And that is the problem, or part of the problem that we see in the very fine work that was done by John and Deborah and others in establishing the agreement to create the World Trade Organization, which was essentially just trying to revive the work that Julio did back in the immediate post-war period, but was not ratified by the U.S. Congress, the Charter for an International Trade Organization. Now, a number of the problems that I was thinking about have already been mentioned, so I'll go through them very quickly. The first was that the GATT, the WTO architects left intact the GATT consensus rule for decision making without assessing how such concord could be achieved among a growing number of players in world trade negotiations. Throughout most of the GATT era, decisions were made by transatlantic compact. The United States and the European communities agreed, and it was done. Most countries weren't involved or even notified. And most countries didn't have to assume the obligations, and they didn't care. Most countries didn't have a stake in global trade or investment. They were out of the system, and in fact, there wasn't that much globalization, so there wasn't, trade wasn't even that important for some countries like the United States. That's all changed. You all know about that. But the decision-making process, or rather the consensus-building process, was not addressed in the beginnings of the WTO. And once you got another really big player in the club, when China joined a little less than a decade ago, then the problems got much more difficult. So I think it's important to maintain the consensus rule. I don't think there are many countries that would actually be the one country to hold up their flag and say, I am stopping this whole process, because they'd get stepped on in very practical ways by their trading partners. But there must be a better way of bringing in the new players in world trade and investment that have a vested interest, for the very reason because they have taken the steps to open and reform their economies to take advantage of the global trading system. Now, interestingly, and Julio made this point very eloquently, this has been one of the reasons why there has been a drag in negotiations. And when there is a drag in negotiations, countries turn to other means to try to solve their problems. And some of those problems are solved through unilateral actions. Some of them are solved through subsidies. Some of them are solved through bilateral or regional agreements. But it's all done on a much more pragmatic basis, with discrimination, with distortions to international trade and investment. And I think the proliferation of regionalism, particularly in Asia over the past decade, is a rational reaction to the breakdown in consensual politics within the WTO. And that's why I put this issue of decision-making and consensus as my number one concern or problem with the architectural blueprint of the WTO. The second problem is one that has been discussed quite a bit, and I'm not the expert on it, but it has to do with the fact that the judicial function has far outpaced the legislative one, and Jennifer just spent quite a bit of time on it. Deborah also mentioned that many of these of the GATT rules were never meant to be parsed with legal precision. In fact, if you think about it, most of dispute settlement in the GATT years was based on traditional disputes over border measures. But now, increasingly, the body of rules in the trading system is about domestic policies, behind the border policies. And trying to harmonize rules that would cover this vast and very different scope of issues is very difficult. Trying to get an agreement that then is subject to the type of legal precision that we have seen in WTO adjudication is very difficult, because often to get that agreement, negotiators have to fudge. And if you look at the definition of subsidies that I wrote 40 years ago, 35 years ago, there is a fudge. And if a judge looked at that and tried to determine, there is no way you come up with any clear ruling without adding to the body of law. And that's what's happening in some extent, either through WTO adjudication or through national legislation, and which is much more dangerous than the former. The third set of problems is when you have a comprehensive set of obligations that are subject to this rigorous dispute settlement, it essentially raises the entry bar for accession for new members and affects their subsequent behavior in the WTO. Now, for many small countries, it doesn't really affect the organization as a whole. But for big countries, it does. And China is the biggest example. Russia, if it ever decides that it wants to join the WTO, and it changes its mind about four times every year, it is now in a no position, as opposed to some of the comments. But the problem here is that in the case of China, it's clear that the appetite for trade liberalization was largely sated in the accession process. And we've seen Chinese officials becoming increasingly reluctant to offer new concessions in the Doha round. They've made a few to their negotiating to their trading partners in Asia to try to codify or solidify their production network that supplies their raw materials and componentry for Chinese manufacturers, but not so much anywhere else. And those are key problems. I think there are a number of very good ideas on how you go about trying to resolve them. But it is hard to see how WTO reforms to redress these problems could be pursued unless the multilateral negotiating process is validated by a successful conclusion of the Doha round. And if the Doha round fails, who would actually want to go back to Geneva, invest additional time and effort to reconstruct and negotiate an agenda, and then negotiate that, and then spend another 5 or 10 years implementing it? You know, you're talking about 15, 20 years. Well, we live in an era of accelerating globalization, and businesses don't and countries don't have time to do that anymore. There has to be a better way of doing it. And in fact, this is one thing that the WTO architects got exactly right, and it was never implemented by the member countries. The WTO was supposed to be a forum for continuing negotiations. And so these standing bodies that John talked about that do the day-to-day work and actually do a lot of good work, they were supposed to also have the authority to churn out decisions to take care of problems and address new issues as they came up. And instead, we fell back into the old process of negotiating rounds without any of these institutional changes that would improve the efficiency of conducting these types of negotiations. Very hard to do. And when you look at what needs to be done in terms of the substance, it's a broad agenda. And it's one that won't get off the ground until there is a reaffirmation of the credibility and validity of going to Geneva and getting work done. When we were negotiating, people looked at us and they said, oh, the GATT or the WTO, that's where you actually can do business. You don't just go to talk like in the United Nations. You can actually get something done. It'd be a shame to have that legacy and that tradition wither. And I think there is a great opportunity still to conclude the round. I am still one of the optimists around that, and there isn't enough time in this session, if we want to open it up to the floor, to discuss how that can be done. But there is a need to finish and to find a way to modernize multilateralism, to ensure that what the WTO works on and who it works with, because many of the problems of the international economy are not purely trade problems. They're trade finance, they're trade development issues. They're involved with capacity building and investment. They're dealing with the concerns of dealing with problems of health and poverty that have a real impact on economic development. All these things have to be developed and worked on in an integrated fashion. The WTO needs to be there to provide the trade expertise, but it needs to be working in better cohesion with other groups, private and public, international organizations and national agencies to try to improve the economic well-being of the citizens of our countries. And that is the ultimate objective of the exercise of the trade negotiations and of the World Trade Organization. And hopefully we'll find a way to move forward with that. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We did start about 15 minutes late, so we do have some time. I want to give the panelists time to make some concluding remarks, but before I do that, I want to open up to audience members. We also have a reception where you will have nice food and drink, but it's across the hall after this is done, and we will have books of Deborah on sale there, and she can even sign them for you. But before we do that, we wanted to invite you to to come up with any questions you may have. There are two microphones. Please introduce yourself and go ahead, please.
Thank you. My name is Dan McGraw. I'm from the Center for International Environmental Law, CL, and I want to thank the panelists and make three points. The first, in terms of the dispute settlement procedures and mechanisms, there are a couple of major problems that have not been mentioned. The first is that the relationship between WTO law and other law in the world is not really being addressed very well. For example, in the EC biotech case, the WTO essentially refused to take account of the environmental treaty that deals with that issue, and that sort of integration is we had hope after the shrimp turtle case, but now it we're losing that, and that's something that has to be addressed. The second obvious deficit there has to do with transparency, and it seems to me that the WTO has sacrificed huge amounts of credibility because the dispute settlement procedures are so secret. When there have been a couple open hearings, they've not been webcast, by the way, just open to people who are in Geneva and can get clearance. I had staff at the first one. Most of the people in the room were other government delegates who are not allowed into dispute settlement procedures for other cases, and they wanted to know what was going on. That's just one reason, but that to have these be more transparent, but it's certainly one of them. And it brings me to my second point, and that is there may be a way of somehow strengthening that weakest leg, and that is that countries themselves decide whether, even if you don't change the rules about transparency in these dispute settlement procedures, countries themselves can decide to have them be open. And they're not doing that, and maybe there's a way the WTO itself can help encourage them to do that. And the third point is I think a little bit we should try to remain humble in some ways. There are a couple of comments about trying to integrate the whole system and, for example, have all investment law and have the IMF policies be consistent with WTO policies. And we have to remember that the economists don't have all the answers yet. And one example is that all of those 27 or most of those 2,700 bilateral investment treaties forbid restrictions on capital transfers. And the IMF, until very recently, did that as well. And then it realized, whoops, we need to allow countries to do that. That is a very legitimate element of domestic policy making. So the IMF is going 180 degrees different on that. So we have to think about that when we're making these policies. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we have one question about the relationship of WTO law and other law. Did someone want to address that? Yes, Deborah.
Well, I think I have to take that because Jennifer can't. Touch that for obvious reasons. The WTO is kind of unique. It's not the International Court of Justice. It's not a tribunal that parties can go to and can negotiate their own terms of reference and decide among themselves that the tribunal, it's not an arbitral body that they can negotiate their own terms of reference and determine what agreements or what treaties the arbitral body is going to deal with. The WTO quite clearly, if you look at the agreement, you look at the dispute settlement understanding, and you look at the agreements, the WTO only has jurisdiction to deal with the WTO agreement and with the subject matter of the WTO agreements per se. So claims can only be brought under the WTO agreements themselves. That's just the way it works. And WTO panels and the appellate body only have jurisdiction to hear claims brought under the WTO agreements per se. Having said that, as a matter of interpretation, they can look at other treaties in interpreting claims brought under the WTO agreements, and they have done that. So, but they certainly can't, and this is as has been written about, hear claims brought under other international treaties. It's just a matter of their jurisdiction. It's something that's spelled out in the treaty itself, and it's something that, you know, WTO members have determined when they negotiated the treaty. So that's something that is just there. With respect to transparency, quite frankly, I'm very surprised to hear your comments, because things have changed dramatically in the last 15 years with the WTO. Dramatically. Although the rules in the DSU are replete, it's true, with provisions that say that, you know, things should be confidential all over the place, what has happened in practice is that things have really opened up. And not only do countries now make their written submissions available, and of course, you know, panel reports and appellate body reports are made available and all that sort of thing. The one, the appellate body, for heaven's sakes, for many years, has made it clear that amicus curiae briefs can be accepted by panels and the appellate body, and indeed panels and the appellate body have been doing that as a matter of practice, and that's very contentious because most WTO members don't want them to do it, but they have in practice been accepting them. So on that front, transparency is happening. And moreover, with respect to oral hearings and meetings of panels and the appellate body, you were suggesting that the rules provide that meetings of panels and the proceedings of the appellate body are supposed to be closed. Well, indeed, that's what the rules say. But if you look at the practice the last few years, the parties in many disputes have indeed decided among themselves to open them up in many cases. And there's been several examples of this in the last 2 or 3 years, 2 years at least. And, you know, there have been a number of cases where this is happening. So transparency has evolved dramatically in the WTO and dispute settlement, such that the practice is now far different from what the rules provide. So anyway, that's my response to you.
Does anyone else would like to talk either about the other than WTO law or the transparency issue? Respond? No. Please. Go ahead.
This is specifically addressed towards Ms. Hillman. In areas where the DSB has been said to be, let's say, gap-filling, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
In areas where the DSB or the appellate body has been said to be gap-filling, what would you say is the jurisprudence or the areas of the law that you turn to sort of fill in those areas? And the other question is, what do you think is maybe the future of reform in the dispute settlement process?
He wants to know how you make your decisions.
Well, I won't say much other than obviously within the text itself, it calls on us to rely on principles of public international law, which really gets you directly into the Vienna Convention on the Interpretation of Treaties. So the first thing that you would do is to look to the Vienna Convention rules, which basically, you know, prescribe that you are to start with the text itself. So we're not going to start with text other than the WTO agreement. You're going to start exactly in that WTO textual agreement, and then you're going to use the principles of the Vienna Convention, which really require you to interpret that particular provision again, in light of its overall purpose and the context and the meaning of that phrase. And again, in the absence of an ability to interpret it, this would be Article 31C of the Vienna Convention, for those of you out there that are into that. If you then come to the view that you cannot resolve it, you then move to Article 32 of the Vienna Convention, which would suggest that you then can look to some outside sources for purposes of sorting out what was the meaning of, again, that same set of laws. And again, typically in a WTO dispute, that is going to be things like when you're interpreting a tariff schedule, something that the World Customs Organization might have said about a way in which you would interpret a given phrase. So you are still only, at the end of the day, interpreting the WTO law, if you will, the language of the agreement, but you're using these other interpretive tools, again, starting with the Vienna Convention and then looking at other bodies of law that would help you to interpret the WTO law itself. So you are not, in that sense, saying, okay, there isn't any law here, so I'm going to look somewhere else to figure out whether there's some other law that I'm going to interpret. That would not be permitted. Does that more or less answer your...
The future of the appellate process, I think.
The future of the appellate process. I mean, the appellate process itself is interesting in that those, and Julio could tell you more than I, but those that were around at the time of the Uruguay round, I think presumed that something in the order of 10 to 15% of cases would in fact be appealed, because you have to remember an appeal is only in theory an appeal of the law, of the legal interpretation. As it's turned out, approximately two-thirds of cases are being appealed. Of course, the first year that I joined the appellate body, that number went up to 100%. They told me, oh, this is a part-time job, and you can do all of these other things, and then 100% of the cases got appealed. But in terms of, so you are seeing, a significant percentage of cases being appealed, much more, I think, than anyone imagined. The other thing that you are seeing happen in the cases is a significant number, I would say now virtually all, of the cases also include a claim under what is referred to as Article 11 of the Dispute Settlement Understanding, which is claiming that it's a claim related to the facts of the case. So again, you started with the notion of a limited number of appeals, and they were only going to be looking at sort of narrow questions of law, and you were going to be making all of your decisions on these, again, narrow questions of law. And in reality, again, huge numbers of appeals and huge numbers of the appeals are questioning whether or not the panel's appreciation of the facts was consistent with, a fair and objective reading of the facts. So we are seeing many, many cases in which the appellate body is being asked, I don't want to say to be fact finders, but certainly to delve in some depth into the way in which the panel appreciated the facts. So those are clearly trends that we're seeing, and I think that are only going to continue. I don't see a significant drop-off in interest in appeals. Now, truth be told, if you look at the numbers, the number of cases in which the appellate body has simply upheld a panel, you got it perfectly right, A+, we're not changing anything, 4%. Cases in which the appellate body has to some degree modified the opinions of the panel, 81%. So obviously there's a lot of sense of that we may get something out of an appeal, and I think that is enhancing, the number of cases that we're seeing be appealed.
Thank you. I will, one final question. Did anybody else want to respond to that? That was directed to Ms. Hillman. Yes.
The current handicap in Washington, I guess, is there a better chance?
Can you introduce yourself, sir?
Steve Landy, Manchester Trade.
Okay.
The current handicap betting in Washington, is there a better chance that the current Palestinian-Israeli talks have a better chance of resolving themselves, Doha round? I, for one, and I want to refer to an article that Gary Huffbauer, Jeff's wrote recently, that there are a lot of reasons to think it can conclude. We have this small group. There seems now that people have agreed that we're not going to get stuck with a December consensus and so on. There's a lot of things going on. So I, for one, believe that Doha has a chance to go. But what has disappointed me in this panel has been that no one has really identified the real problem with why we really can't make more progress in our trade negotiations. And that was because of the fact that when we went from the GATT to the Doha, the GATT to the WTO, we made this big decision to change the general agreement to talk and talk into a legislative kind of an agreement. If I'm a legislator and somebody's coming back to me and says, by the way, do you want to approve giving up more of your power to this very amorphous group and so on called the WTO? And we all know Jennifer, and how should I say it? Jennifer's major achievement has been that she was a textile negotiator and survived. But putting that aside for a moment, do we want to give it up to this amorphous unknown body? Every time you go into the U.S. Congress and somebody says, you can't protect American jobs by forcing China to increase its value of its currency because of a WTO rule. Every time you go in, you say, I can't pass this particular rule in the environmental area because the WTO says in the PPP system, it says you have to have the least restrictive trade measure. You can't take into account the full cycle of the particular product. Every time, and I'm going to finish now, every time an African country is told, we're sorry, you have to sign an agreement with Europe called the Economic Partnership Agreement, because if not, the WTO will allow Europe to take away your preferences because you're not a least developed country, even though you're pretty poor. I mean, the Cameroons, Gabon are not exactly economic threats. Every time those things happen, people have trouble accepting the WTO. And that's exactly the point I'm trying to make, is that we pass the WTO, or we pass the Uruguay round in a lame duck session of Congress, where you have a bunch of people who are invited to vote, although the vote was, I think, healthy. The problem you're going to face now is, how do you have the same congressman come in having been told 10 times that they can't protect the constituents? Why should they pass a new agreement? Thank you.
Yeah, I don't think that was a question, but I think that there was... There might be an opportunity. Would you like to say something?
Yes, Steve, you're wrong. the issue you posed was discussed in great detail in the implementing legislation for the Uruguay round and the establishment of the World Trade Organization. And it was argued very clearly and correctly that nothing in the WTO can compel action by an individual government. You comply with your WTO obligations because it is in your own interest to do so. And when people say the WTO forces us to do this, it is because there are a lot of people that want to do that and know that it is a good thing for the United States. Now, there are other areas where there are gray issues, new areas that Dan and I have debated quite frequently in the TPAC with regard to environmental law and the trading system because of the ambiguity of the exceptions under GATT Article 20, where there is probably some need for elaboration, both to clarify the extent of the exceptions and perhaps to negotiate new safe harbors. Which is one of the issues that Gary Huffbauer and I have been talking about with regard to climate change policies. But there is nothing that would ever compel the United States to act, and there are very few countries that can take any action that would strongly influence the United States to act unless we thought it was in our best interest to do so. Now, in the case of Mexico, it is retaliating against the United States, and we have not responded. In the case of Brazil, they have started retaliating, and we have decided to buy them off for the short period of time with a type of compensation that's essentially a bribe to delay action for a year or two, because their retaliation contains some actions that have systemic consequences. But nothing... And the Congress has acceded to that because they'd rather continue our policies than go into full compliance with the rulings. So I think you stated it a little too starkly. I think there is a great value to having the WTO rules. As other speakers said earlier, there is a great value in complying with our obligations because we want to use the system to force compliance by other countries. And so I think
He stated it a little too strongly.
Thank you very much. I want to give an opportunity for some concluding remarks. Professor Jackson, maybe? Ambassador Vacarte?
No, just a postscript here. Jeffrey has spoken about the American situation. Say my own country, or many countries in the world, let's submit to Parliament the full text of the treaties they sign. And that text becomes national law. I think I should clarify that the American system is different from most countries. The community does the same as the United States. The community signs an international agreement and modifies its internal legislation to comply, which is, I understand, what the United States does. In most countries, the procedure is different. You take the treaty, the 577 pages of WTO agreements, you bang them into Parliament, and Parliament accepts them. So I think I should make that clear, because we are talking of different ball games, although in the end, it all comes down that if you infringe a WTO commitment, whatever you've done, they're going to bring you into this dispute settlement system. Thank you.
I'm going to invite any concluding remarks not related to the comment that was just given. Professor Jackson, perhaps? No?
I'm very happy that Julio made that point, because it actually proves the point that Dan McGraw made before, that economists aren't always right, or at least don't tell the whole story. But I must say that if you think about it, economists do have all the answers, and I want this to be known in a law school. Economists do have all the answers. They just can't agree among themselves on which are the right answers.
Very good.
Well,
then I will thank the panelists, thank your speakers today, thank all of you for attending. This session will be available as a webcast and a podcast on the WCL website, the special events sort of dot on our you click on it on our website. Please join us at the reception. It's in student lounges across from the elevators for food and refreshments. Thank you.
Slide procedure.
There were papers on a desk. Were there papers on a desk?
Very easy.
Papers. There were papers.
Yes, Meritz, I was in inside U.S. training.
No,
I thought you were.
I was a host.
Okay.
There he is, right here.
Precious, it does our own. What? Say what?
Oh my goodness, yes. Located here? Excellent. Good luck.
Parking right on the record.
Is quando pega, mas é que você.
É, pode é, aí agarra mesmo.
Aí.
Aí não solta.
Aí não solta.
Que horror, hein, rapaz?
Saudade.
Que coisa
feia.
Oh!
Onde eu ia, né?
I'm Philip Goffman. Congratulations, this is my colleague.
I'm Flavio. Alumni embassy as well. My pleasure.
Luis is traveling, as you know, right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. We are eager to help the DJ here. The pastor is coming. He left. He's in Wisconsin today. Was here until yesterday. Time of yeah, he came very quickly.
He was always very busy. Yeah. But you know, he and I are old friends. Yeah. So I knew him before he became.
He taught here.
He taught here, yes. When I first started here, we talked to each other.
Very good. And we'll see each other.
It is coming.
But I have to leave. Just. You know why I have to go?
We should be able to put something up. Yeah, that shouldn't be hard. We don't want to put something that fits people in our
house. Muy inteligente, muy vigoroso. Es necesario que haya logrado. Es un gran esfuerzo.
That's right. We've got people to talk to here.
Yes.
I think most of us think balance of power shift. We needed to have some of that. Maybe, but when you have a census goal, for instance, and other things, so often,
¿Por qué vamos a dar concesiones a cambio de qué?